Good morning. Yes, good morning. We have one more case set for oral argument today. That is case number A19-728, State of Minnesota versus Josiah Taylor. The appellant is Absolute Bail Bonds, Inc. There was no respondent's brief filed. I believe the court issued a order under pursuant to Rule 142 saying the case would be submitted based solely upon the appellant's brief and the appellant's oral argument. So we will allow appellant's counsel 15 minutes for oral argument, and then the case will be submitted. You may proceed. Please introduce yourself at the beginning, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Scott Nielsen, Henson & Efron, here on behalf of Absolute Bail Bonds. I apologize in advance if I cough, which I just did. This court should reverse and order reinstatement discharge of the bond for three reasons not actually in the brief. As the court is aware, there was a prior appeal, and the prior panel on August 19th, on the same facts, the same issues, ordered full reinstatement discharge. And the prior panel on the same facts found that the first, second, and third Shetsky factors favored full reinstatement and discharge. We had tried to consolidate the appeals, but that did not happen. So as a result, we think that whether it's collateral estoppel or res judicata, I think certainly collateral estoppel is more direct. It could also be res judicata, but I'm not sure it needs to get to the breadth of res judicata to prevail on these issues. They were the identical issues under collateral estoppel. There was a final judgment. The state was a party and had a full opportunity to be heard. And so...
So that the district court this time around addressed each of those factors and hadn't on the first?
The district court actually, I think, also addressed some of those factors in the prior orders as well. You know, from my reading of the prior orders.
Our opinion said otherwise, didn't we? I mean, our court's prior opinion, I thought the opinion said that the district court omitted full analysis.
It did. The prior opinion did say that. But nonetheless, the prior opinion did go through those facts and analyze them. And so those issues were fully addressed, and the respondent had an opportunity to address them in front of the district court and the Court of Appeals and did not. The Court of Appeals nonetheless took those facts and analyzed them, and I think because of that, collateral estoppel would still nonetheless apply. Also, I think the court could look at the law of the case doctrine given the prior appeal decision in this case, and that doctrine generally refuses to reopen what has been decided. The Supreme Court of Minnesota in Huff Transit versus Herrig, which is 373 Northwest 2nd at 327, said that the law of the case doctrine is based upon a policy of ending litigation, and adjudication on a first appeal is final, and is the law of the case on all subsequent appeals in which the same facts are involved. And then the Supreme Court of Minnesota in 1950 explained that the law of the case can be applied to the same facts, even if it's involving different parties, which is not the case here. And State versus Bentley, 231 Minnesota, 531, 1950, there was similar condemnation actions involving flood control project, and the Supreme Court said the law of the case doctrine can apply even if to subsequent appeals involving different parties because the same issues were involved and decided in a prior appeal. Finally, Your Honor, and this is my fault, while I did reference Form 702 in my briefing and did reference that the court is limited to the nature of the contract, that is a bail bond, it cannot go outside that contract. I did not reference that Form 702 says that the obligation of the surety becomes null and void upon dismissal of the charge or sentencing. This particular case was dismissed in December of 2018, and then 2 weeks later, the court forfeited the bond. I would argue that the court did not have an ability or jurisdiction because the statute already says that the obligation is null and void upon dismissal. I don't think the court is at liberty to forfeit and forfeit a bond and make the bonding company pay a penalty after the bond is null and void per the state of Minnesota.
Just to be clear, was that an argument you made in your brief?
It is not.
Okay.
I'm acknowledging that I missed that, even though I knew it, but I think it was because I had just written the prior brief. It didn't come to me.
Didn't the court preliminarily forfeit the bail when there was a non-appearance?
No. There was a reference in MnSIS to some reference to forfeiture in this particular case, but we've never seen any forfeiture. We didn't get notice of any forfeiture. We asked, was there actually a forfeiture? We'd like to see the order. It was never produced. And I think if there was a prior forfeiture in this case, the court wouldn't have forfeited again. They would have just produced the document where it was forfeited. So we don't know if there was a clerical issue where the clerk just put on MnSIS forfeiture, but there was no order to be found. And so therefore, the court then, 2 weeks after dismissal, forfeited it. Even absent the preclusive effect of the prior appeal, which I think controls the decision here, this appeal tests whether the rules set forth by the Supreme Court and this court actually have meaning and weight, or are district courts allowed to simply pay lip service to them? Maybe that's not a perfect way to put it, but as this court found in the prior appeal, it's important to note that the bail bond statutes are supposed to be liberally construed. The district court here appears to have used more of a strict construction instead of the liberal construction. Another important principle laid out by the Supreme Court and this court is that forfeitures are supposed to be kind of proportional to the claim prejudice. 100% forfeiture of $25,000 or $116,000 on the four bonds is not proportionate to the claim prejudice to the state when the state wasn't actually prejudiced and acknowledged. There's an acknowledgement it wasn't prejudiced. Also, the Supreme Court says that forfeitures are not meant to be to punish the surety or to increase the state's revenue. If this forfeiture is allowed to stand, then that rule, I suggest, rings hollow. I am not aware of any case in Minnesota in the history of bail bonds, millions of bail bonds, where a district court forfeited 100% of the bond, an amount as much as $116,000, where a defendant was out of custody for only 27 days, remained in contact with the bail bond company was trying to get him in, and maintain 100% forfeiture. That has never happened. You know, either in a district court or certainly on appeal that I've ever been able to see. Also, the district court, unlike the prior appeal, the district court actually forfeited more than the bond amount. The district court tagged on additional $100, so she forfeited $25,100. And I don't think the court has authority to do that under the bail bond statutes.
What about the fact that you're correct that I think that this appeal is based on the same underlying facts as the prior appeal, but the district court in this order went through an analysis, and we have a deferential standard of review. We review, I believe, for abuse of discretion.
Don't think the abuse of discretion is ever is meant to be a a saving grace for a district court who disregards the law. I do not think the district court here followed the law. She did not use a liberal construction standard. And in addition, as this court found in the prior appeal, the court found the first, second, and fourth factors favored reinstatement and discharge. I think is the court aware of the facts of this case? I can go through the facts. I can go through more legal argument. I'm not sure where you would like me to focus.
I think we're familiar with the facts, unless
okay.
There are questions about factual issues. But
Your Honors, the first factor we submit favors reinstatement and discharge. The defendant was only out of custody a mere 27 days. He fired his public defender, or terminated him, which probably obviously was not a good decision, tried to appear the second day of trial, and then the third day didn't appear because he was afraid, and he was trying to hire private counsel. The bonding company obtained the name of the private counsel. The defendant actually did hire him, and this is an unusual situation for the bonding company because usually people are running or they're not cooperating with the bonding company. This defendant was actually reaching out to the bonding company, telling them what's going on. I'm trying to work with my private lawyer. I'm trying to obtain money for the private lawyer. It was a different situation. He gave them their number he was at. They could hear children in the background. And so they did not think he was running. Nonetheless, the bonding company, looking at the third Shetsky factor, looking at the third Shetsky factor, engaged in, good faith efforts to still try to locate him. It is not always easy to locate someone when they're trying not to be found. They had numerous conversations with the defendant and his mother, the co-signer. They gathered information on the defendant, his mother, his wife, his sister, his father, his cousins, and some associates to see if they could try to pinpoint his location. They used computer-based research tools and search social media sites trying to find him. They then provided this information to a bounty hunter to go out into the streets and locate him, because obviously before you send out a bounty hunter, you need to do some investigation so there's actually information and they're not just driving around the state of Minnesota. But before the bounty hunter actually went into the streets, by everybody's good graces, he was apprehended on April 1 and returned to custody. So it is illogical, as the district court said, that these were not enough good faith efforts. As this prior panel found, these were enough good faith efforts and were more than the good faith efforts that were exhibited by the bonding company in the Farsdale case, which also was a reinstatement discharge. It is an error of law and illogical for something so positive, a quick return to custody, to be used as a sword against the bonding company. Obviously, the quicker someone is returned to custody, the less time the bonding company has to mount the kind of evidence this district court wanted. The bounty hunters did this on this day and this on this day. If you've got 90 days or 180 days, obviously there's more of that evidence to present. This is an unusual case because the defendant was actually cooperating with us by keeping everything informed. Finally, obviously, Your Honors, the fourth factor deals with the prejudice of the state. The prior panel and the district court judge noted there was no prejudice to the state. We submit, Your Honor, that the prior panel's opinion establishes that the issues decided in that case should control here, whether under collateral estoppel, res judicata, or law of the case. And in any event, Your Honor, the court certainly is at liberty, given that the respondent did not participate either in the district court or in the court of appeals, to consider the fact that the district court should not have forfeited a bond after it was null and void per Minnesota law, because the case had already been dismissed. If the court has any other questions.
It appears not.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Nielsen. Case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days as required by statute. That is our last case for oral argument today, so the court is now in recess.